folks who did come out and support them in person and continue to support these groups. Another thing I would recommend listening to, and I have mentioned this before, is the Bundyville podcast put together by Leah Sotil, and particularly the second season of the podcast. The first season goes into a lot of things that happened with the Bundys, but the second season really goes into the history and the growth and an incredible amount of detail I've not seen anywhere else of these far-right groups in Stevens County, Washington, and also around Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And, you know, the Aryan Nation was bankrupted and put out of business, but there still remain these other groups. And they are, she has some amazing audio that was smuggled from these meetings where you can hear them speaking plainly about these things in a way that they don't speak in front of people who are not members of their group. And so I think that being in the Pacific Northwest, it's really important that we take a look at this. It's not something we want to take a look at, but, you know, we've seen these groups come through Portland. We've seen them, really try to stir up violence. You know, the Patriot Prayer folks that marched through Portland even before the pandemic, and where these people are at now. And so, but thank you so much. I'm at the last minute here. So once again, I'm Jacqueline Keeler, and I thank you for listening again for another episode of American Standoff. And I hope that we can begin to really change this and make an America that is not based in white supremacist domestic terrorism. I think that's a small thing to want and a very necessary thing. Thank you so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Okay. Steve Almond is the author of 12 books of fiction, essays, and nonfiction, as well as a master writing teacher. He has taught in universities, Boston College and Emerson, and currently teaches continually sold-out classes at nonprofits such as Grub Street and Hugo House. His nonfiction bestsellers include Candy Freak and Against Football, and his newest, William Stoner and the Battle for the Inner Life. His short stories have been widely anthologized and awarded. For 4 years, he hosted the New York Times Dear Sugar podcast with his friend Cheryl Strayed. He's also known as a publishing renegade, calling out the cynical mainstream publishing industry and self-publishing and marketing his books. All the Secrets of the World is his first novel. Anthony Doerr calls Steve Almond's All the Secrets of the World at once a media critique, a coming-of-age story, a meticulously plotted police procedural, an exploration of racial paranoia, and a haunting account of lust and longing on the fringes of what is allowable. Welcome to Between the Covers, Steve Almond.
Thank you. I'm happy to be between the covers.
Your novel in itself is the end of a personal saga. In Confessions of a Failed Novelist, your essay, you document your previous novels that you wrote on the way to this novel. Each, you say, showed you your ultimate job as a writer to impel my people tenderly and ruthlessly toward the truth of themselves. Can you talk about how this novel came together in your life in this way?
Yeah, I mean, the central thing I would say is that I put too much pressure on myself for decades to write a novel. It became this kind of obsession, and not a positive obsession, like an ego obsession, like I must write a novel or I'm not a legitimate writer. Maybe everybody who's creative or everybody who's ambitious has something that they set out that's really important to them. And I think that's good to have good goals, but sometimes it has the effect in the arts, if you're so obsessed with the idea that you should write this thing, you're not really asking the right question. The right question is, do you want to write this thing? Not do you feel like you have to because your ego demands it. So for years and years, I was writing these terrible novels. A friend of mine said to me, Steve, I don't think you really want to write a novel. I think you want to be a novelist. And I was furious with this person. How dare you? But they were right. That's why we get furious, because people you know, they'd nail us. And what they were saying in a kind of a blunt way was, you're doing this to satisfy your ego, not because you're curious about this set of characters and their experiences. So I finally, rounding into my 50s, said, okay, I give up. I don't have to write a novel. The world certainly isn't waiting for a novel from me. I was happy to sort of lower, you know, put down my sword and say, whatever, maybe I'll never write a novel. There's lots of other things that I can write and enjoy writing that are meaningful. And really, almost the moment I did that, a certain kind of imaginative space opened up. And into that space, the muse walked this young woman, Lorena Sines, and she just took root in my mind. I know where the incidents in the book come from, but I don't know why she in particular walked in my life. And I don't particularly want to know. The muse has its own reasons for doing things. What I'm getting at is that it was all the failure and all the ego need and desperation that was keeping me from meeting Lorena. And when she finally showed up, it was much more a matter of recognizing that she was up against a terrible internal conflict. She's this brilliant, ambitious, smart, courageous young woman, but she's Honduran American and her family's undocumented. So for her, she's both desperate to become visible in the world and be seen and regarded and respected and desired. And that is at the very same time, terribly dangerous in ways that she can't apprehend. Once I had a handle on that as her central internal conflict, I knew where the danger was. She just raced me through the book in a way. I was racing after her to keep up with all of the things that she says and does that are so ridiculously courageous and dangerous for her.
Maybe we can start out by you reading a scene so we can get a feel for the
novel. In fact, I'll read a scene where you can see some of her unusual courage and her curiosity. So the novel begins with Lorena, who's in eighth grade, being paired for a science fair with the most glamorous girl in her class, Jenny Stallworth, who's beautiful and tall and blonde. And this, because it's set in 1981, there are no screens. This isn't done by Google Docs or text. They actually, people used to go to people's houses. Like, that was how we did business back in the early 80s. And so Lorena walks into the Stallworth mansion. She's immediately dazzled. I mean, this is a kind of life that she's never seen before. And both of the Stallworth parents, Rosemary, Jenny's mom, and Marcus, her dad, take a kind of unnatural interest in her. And so they get the idea that Marcus should help the girls with their science fair project. Turns out he's a zoologist. He's a research zoologist. And they agree that they're going to go out into the desert and they're going to, you know, sort of, Marcus has a surprise, something he wants to show the girls. But this surprise requires them putting snake chaps on. And the moment Jenny gets snake chaps on, she's like, I am not going out into any environment where I need snake chaps to be there. She freaks out. But Lorena is totally a gamer. And so she heads out there with Marcus Stallworth and Jenny's older brother, Glenn. And I'll just read a little bit of that.
Sounds great.
Mr. Stallworth led them into the darkness. He lugged an oversized lantern, which he set down on a small rise. Close your eyes and keep them shut until I say. Do it, Glenn murmured. Okay, Mr. Stallworth said, open. An iridescent purple light gleamed out in all directions. Lorena's eyes scrolled an ocean of sand, upon which now lay scattered scores of tiny glow-in-the-dark toys, the sort kids on TV pulled from cereal boxes. Then the toys began to move. Lorena gasped. These were living creatures, many-legged and scrabbling like tiny lobsters. Welcome to Scorpionville, Glenn said. Lo glanced at the sand around her feet. A scorpion the length of a hairpin labored under the weight of its stinger, which hung like a fanged jewel over the armored segments of its body. Don't be frightened, Mr. Stallworth said. He was suddenly right beside her. I'm not, Lorena replied. What do you think, he asked. There, she cast about for the right word, stunned to find the truth in such a simple one. They're beautiful. She could feel Mr. Stallworth inspecting her face, trying to figure out if she really meant it. He took off his glasses and began furiously polishing the lenses with the hem of his shirt. For a queer moment, Lo imagined grabbing his glasses and tossing them away. We gonna take any home? Glenn asked. Mr. Stallworth pulled a small flashlight from his pocket and swept the purple beam across the sand. We might as well see who's out hunting tonight. To Lorena's astonishment, Mr. Stallworth knelt down and guided a scorpion onto his palm. The animal was the size of a matchbox. Its pinchers pawed the air. Shouldn't you have gloves? Lorena said. You just come at them from behind, Glenn said. They can't sting backwards. They're not aggressive animals, Mr. Stallworth explained. They just want to be left alone. Why do they shine? Lorena said. Nobody knows. Fluorescence must convey some kind of evolutionary advantage, but it's still their little secret. Glenn asked his father to find a scorpion he could pick up. Mr. Stallworth scanned the ground with his magic light. These are your best bet, sand scorpions. Aren't they poisonous? Lorena said. This species isn't too bad, unless you're an insect. She watched Mr. Stallworth gently prod the scorpion onto Glenn's hand. The creature scampered along his knuckles. It looked glum, menacing, painfully shy. Are you going to pick one up? Glenn asked Lorena. I'm sure she's had enough excitement for one night, Mr. Stallworth said. I'm not scared, Lorena said. The words came out louder than she intended. More softly, she added, I'd like to hold one. Mr. Stallworth switched on the lantern. He stared at her face again, half in wonder, and picked up another one, bluish under the light. A gentle species, he said. Its sting no worse than a wasp. She reached out, and Mr. Stallworth uncurled her fingers. The earth was trembling beneath her. Then she realized that it was her and not the earth. You don't have to do this, Mr. Stallworth said. I know. Do you trust me? She met his gaze and nodded, and Mr. Stallworth lowered the animal onto her. No way, Glenn said. The creature clung to the knob of her wrist like a charm. Slowly, tentatively, it began to move toward her hand, the legs rising and falling like jointed oars. Lorena's pulse lurched. She closed her eyes to keep from flinching. Tiny feet tickled her palm. She felt a dampness beneath her clothes, the dizziness of what was going to happen next. When she could stand it no longer, she opened her eyes. The scorpion was perched on her thumb, perfectly still, its stinger hoisted like a tiny scythe. He appears to like you, Mr. Stallworth said. So you can see that she is not your average bear. She's very brave and very curious. That's really what Marcus sees in her, is this scientific mind asking questions, trying to understand. She's taken up by the mystery of the scorpion's glow. She races to the library to see if she can discover and comes up with what I think is a rather elegant theory for why scorpions glow, which she presents, to Mr. Stallworth. And, you know, they're really quite enthralled by one another in certain ways that I think are kind of beautiful and fascinating, the respect for one another's minds, that sense of this person's curious in the same way I am, and then in other ways that are quite unnatural and upsetting, which I'll let the reader discover.
In your interview with Cheryl Strayed recently, the two of you discussed radical empathy in regards to this book, and occupying this sort of empathic space that you do when you both did the Dear Sugar columns. And we're talking about people's stated and unstated secrets. Can you speak about how you feel that radical empathy has evolved in your life and how it shows up in your writing of this novel?
For sure. I mean, the whole gig in writing for me is that good writing has sympathy and understanding for all the characters, which is actually necessary, since if the story is any good, some people are going to act badly. And they're not going to act badly because they were born evil, going, you know, wah, 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 I want to torture somebody. You know, somehow people's love gets distorted into destructive impulses. And the author, one of the central projects of the author, or maybe for us as Sugars, was to understand what is it that causes people to be destructive rather than loving, to be aggrieved rather than forgiving, you know, to be cruel rather than merciful. And that's what I was asking of all the characters in the book. That's easy for certain characters. Lorena is somebody that I was rooting for from the beginning. She's not, it's not that she's pure of heart. She's complicit in certain ways, although she doesn't realize the dangers that she's getting herself and her family into. But there are other characters, the Stallworth parents, Nancy Reagan, who winds up being in this novel, whose behaviors are really destructive. They're entitled people. And they're sort of like Tom and Daisy Buchanan in Gatsby. They were reckless people, is what Fitzgerald says. But that novel, although I love it, that line and that portrayal of Tom and Daisy Buchanan has always bothered me, because there's a reason why Tom and Daisy Buchanan are so cosseted within their privilege, are so cruel and inconsiderate. And it's not because they're evil. It's because somehow the story they were born into, they behave, they have to have power in a certain way, and they have to, there's something in them that needs status and power over others, dominion. And that's not a strong, noble thing. That's like a weak thing. And I don't think Gatsby, the novel, The Great Gatsby, really investigates that. But for me, when I get to Nancy Reagan, somebody I've spent four decades kind of flattening out into a caricature of this, whatever, you know, she is kind of obsessed with fashion and money and power and kind of destructive and naive when it comes to people who have a lot less, disenfranchised people. For me, the struggle was to say, well, but wait a second, how can I come to understand the way that Nancy Reagan is behaving so that the reader doesn't just go, oh yeah, that jerk. Because I don't think the reader should ever enjoy the privilege of that kind of moral laziness of saying, oh, that person's a jerk. Oh, that's just a bad egg. I think the job of fiction is to lead, and good writing in general, is to lead the reader into their own moral confusions, is to make it clear that every single one of us is an amalgam of the kind of the holy and the profane and the loving and the destructive. So for Nancy Reagan, it took a lot of thinking about what was going on to realize, wait a second, she loves her husband very purely. She believes he's sort of been sent to lead the nation. And she believes, even though I think his what he was pitching is ultimately quite fraudulent and damaging, and we're sort of living with the end results of the Reagan Revolution right now, or the logical conclusion of them, I think she believed purely that he was the person who was going to lead the country back to greatness. And when he is shot early in the book, as there was this assassination attempt on him, you know, like any loving partner, she is in a kind of panic, and she will adopt any belief system that she believes will keep her husband safe. Well, that's all of us, actually. We all would behave that way. Maybe Nancy needed to grab onto astrology and start running the presidential schedule on the basis of whether the moon was rising in Aquarius or whatever. And we could tease that or say, what a damaging thing for the United States. But the deeper human view of that, the radically empathic view of that, is to say, oh, she's a loving partner whose husband was, you know, whose partner was, her partner was almost killed, and she's going to adopt any belief to keep him safe. We would do the same thing. We've done the same thing.
I like what you're saying about how it sort of implicates the reader that you have to stand in her shoes, and the writer into you have to write it so that the reader can't look from far away at the character. They have to.
It's more than far away. I mean, it's actually can't look down on the character.
Down, yeah.
There's this thing called the ironic mode, which is when satire is in the ironic mode, where you're sort of looking at people from above and saying, oh, look at them, those poor, pathetic human beings, like you're some kind of callous god gazing down upon your characters amid their folly. I think that's bull. I think the job of a writer is to make the reader have to examine their own stuff, not to have them sit in judgment of the characters, but in judgment of themselves because of what the characters endure. Mm-hmm. And for me, that meant that I had to go into all their points of view so that I could start to understand the police officers, Nancy Reagan, or the Stallworths, or the people who have more power in the story. I want to understand, well, how are the systems of power that they're wrapped up in changing their incentives? How are they creating blind spots morally for them so that they behave in a way that they think is heroic or at least noble or required by duty when it's actually quite monstrous and destructive?
You've actually spoken about the times, the two periods of time when you wrote parts of the book. So right. That was my next question about it, was your vantage point with very different cultural moments happening. The first, I think you said, was the first half was written before the 2016 election?
Correct, yeah.
Can you talk about how the themes or characters changed across?
Yeah, I mean, it was, as people will recall, there was a certain, I won't say innocence, but I feel like morally what's happening is like trap doors keep opening. And we keep realizing that that there is what we thought was the bottom. Surely at this point, decency will take root. The shame will take over and people will say, that's it. We can't go along with tearing families apart at the border. That's too cruel. We can't go along with a leader who's got no conception of what a plague is going to bring to the country and it costs hundreds of thousands of lives. No, we can't go along with an insurrection where people are storming the Capitol and beating cops. We can't go along with that. We can't go along with a kind of political philosophy that stokes up mass murder against brown people. You keep expecting that there's going to be some bottom, and the trapdoor keeps opening, keeps getting deeper and deeper. So for me, I wrote the first half of this book before the 2016 election, when it seemed that the trapdoor was sort of several levels up. And by the time I returned to it, then, you know, the election starts to happen. I go crazy and, you know, write a couple of books in an effort to, I just couldn't be in an imaginative space. Like a lot of people, my capacity to stay in an imagined world, which is quite fragile, was sort of crushed by the awful blender of a news cycle that we kept sticking our hands into and our hearts just grinded us up. And it's everything that was going on. I was like, I can't get back to Lorena. There's too much, there's stuff on fire. So when I returned to it in 2018, I knew that the book had energy. I knew that I was still really curious and excited to spend time with Lorena, but where the book was headed made more and more sense to me, because at that time, the US government was in the business of separating traumatized refugee families, small kids, some of them really babies, from their parents. Of all the unconscionable things that this fraud, this crook, imposed on the country, that was, to me, clearly the lowest, because those families and those kids in particular are permanently traumatized by that experience. And it was clear, increasingly as that's going on, that the story I'm writing is headed in that direction. I don't want to give away a lot of spoiler alerts, but it's no coincidence that later in the book, we move into the point of view of a character who had to make a journey from Central America to Mexico to the United States as a young kid. And it's no coincidence that his experiences, even though they're not caught by the American authorities, are completely traumatizing, because that is what happens when people have to leave their home, usually under duress, almost inevitably under duress, and especially small kids have to travel thousands of miles through dangerous terrain. They're terrified, they don't know what's going on. And a lot of what's going on is dangerous and violent. They sense the worry and the peril that's all around them. The adult world can't keep them safe from that. And, you know, it's clear to me now that it was important for me to try to imagine my way in, to the extent I can, to what it would be like to be a migrant making that journey, and the way in which there's a certain kind of damage that's done to you that you never get over, that winds up being part of the reason there's a terrible price to be paid in the novel. It was increasingly clear that one of the moral subjects of the book was what I call the criminalizing of the American dream, that we've turned the immigration process into what amounts to a criminalizing of the American dream, because every immigrant, wherever they come from, but especially if they come from danger and privation, comes to America because they believe the American dream. They believe in that mansion on the hill that Reagan talked about, that beacon of hope, that Statue of Liberty, whatever it is. They're like the truest believers. I think part of the reason that a certain kind of American hates immigrants so much is they've lost hope in the country, and they can't stand to see people coming in who believe so purely in an idea and a set of possibilities that feels to them extinguished.
I like that idea. I think I'm going to take up the idea of the American dream in a later question, but one of the things I love about this novel is all of the oppositions that are set up. So I thought I would just name some of them and then just let you riff on whatever you want to go for.
Sure.
Science versus anti-science. Mm-hmm. Astrology is one thing. Those with power, be it political or organizational, like police departments, versus the most invisible and powerless members of society navigating that world, undocumented community, women, children, working class. Coming of age as an adolescent, as a moneyed, privileged teen versus a lesser privileged, undocumented teen. And of course, scorpions, by reputation on one side versus reality or their own sort of self-image.
Yeah, I mean, I love, this is definitely, I'm flattered that you recognize this is a book that is about science and faith, and it is about the powerful and the powerless. And it definitely is about, I'll take up scorpions because to me that was the biggest surprise, was I read you that scene that's about Lorena going out in the desert. It will shock nobody to hear that I had that experience as a young reporter in El Paso, Texas, years ago. I was taken out into the desert and, you know, just on assignment, and these guys put a lamp and lit it up, and there were all these glowing scorpions. And, you know, like anything that ends up in a book, that was sticking around in my unconscious for a long time. What I didn't realize about scorpions is how exquisitely human they are. We view them as very primitive, very dangerous, very alien. Even the look of them gives us the creeps, and that's bioevolutionary. They crawl around at night, they can sting you. We come by that phobia honestly. But in fact, as Marcus points out to Lorena, scorpions have hairs all over their legs, and they can, like Marcus himself, and they can feel a single grain of sand. They hunt by touch and vibration. They can feel a single grain of sand moving 10 yards away. To me, that is a description of how exquisitely sensitive human beings are. To me, that calls to mind what it's like to be at my dinner table, or what it was like to be at my dinner table as a child, and how you can read the vibe of your parents, your siblings, your beloveds so powerfully. It's just, you can walk into a room and one glance or one shift or one body language, some gesture, you know, oh my God, something's up. There's tension, there's anger, I feel like, and especially maybe having adolescents in the home, they're just like wearing their skin on the outside. They're just turned inside out. They're so sensitive. So it was fascinating for me to think about this animal that's viewed as having armor and being so dangerous and so forth, is actually tremendously sensitive. And the duality that I love as well is that they view themselves, the scorpions themselves, they view themselves as prey, as the victim, as the vulnerable party. We view them as predatory. And the truth is, of course, they're both like us. None of us act in the book or outside of it, none of us view ourselves as the bad actor, as the villain. We always have a sense that we're the vulnerable one. And even when we're behaving destructively, that's just what we have to do to protect ourselves. It's just reasonable self-defense. Of course, that's a fraudulent story and it's quite dangerous, but I think it's really part of the human arrangement. There's also the final thing about scorpions that I love, which is they are really creatures that are hidden creatures. They're covert, they're hermits, they hide from view, but involuntarily, under the right circumstances, they glow. And that to me is really a lot of what Lorena's like, and all of us, that when we're given a certain kind of attention or regard, when the frequency of the light is right that's cast upon us, we can't do anything about it. We light up, we become visible. And for the scorpions, that's dangerous. And for Lorena, it's really dangerous.
So just staying with Lorena for a second, your character, your main protagonist, is demographically as different from you as possible. What are your thoughts about this very lively current debate in the literary community about representation, who gets to write about what, and what kind of character? I know you've been thinking out loud about this stuff. Would love to hear.
Yeah, it's totally, look, I mean, what's been going on for most, for all of human history is that, or at least the vast majority of it, civilized, what we call civilized, which is actually the most barbarous and brutal, but whatever, you know what I mean? Recent history, history that's written down, is really the story of white guys, more or less, or guys with power anyway, always men, almost entirely, 99.999% powerful men, usually powerful European men. And that's been history. And there has been not a complete absence, but a severe underrepresentation of the lives of different people. This is why, you know, Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States is so powerful, because it says, wait a second, stop looking at Columbus. What about the Taino Indians? What about the native people, et cetera? And that debate, which is in certain precincts, is being, you know, furiously fought against by people who are taking up arms to try to protect some kind of fantasized version, fear of a brown planet. In other precincts, like the literary world, there is a long overdue reckoning with the fact that guys who look like me, and guys, and straight hetero white guys, have been the predominant voices in literature, and that that is excluding and not making space for a whole range of stories that exist alongside white guys that need to be heard. I think that's long overdue, and I think that there's a fair argument to be made that the people who should tell those stories are the people who have lived them, that there are great pieces of writing by Luis Urrea, anything he writes, Children of the Land, is another, you know, fantastic, I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter. There are all these amazing books that are told by Latinx people, that are written by Latinx people who have lived the experience of their characters. I think that's great. For me, I was not thinking, I would like to choose somebody other than me to write about for this novel. I really, the muse delivered Lorena Sines to me, and Jenny Stallworth and all the other characters in the book, but Lorena was the one that I was most drawn to. And that was probably from reading lots of Dickens, where all these, you know, young intrepid characters, or Jane Eyre, or whatever, who were up against it. But the other thing is, when you're writing, you, for me anyway, you're not thinking about, well, what are the representation issues? And later on, you definitely should. But for me, I'm thinking, okay, Lorena's just done this. What does that mean? What kind of danger is she in now? How, is she going to get out of it? Is she going to save herself and her people? Those are the questions that I'm asking. After I finished the book, I definitely thought about, oh my gracious, I appear to have written a book that's way outside of my experience, which, by the way, is a good thing. If I was only writing about my experience, I would be centering straight white male stories, you know, sort of told about whatever stuff that's interesting, like the creative, you know, sort of your creative aspirations or self-actualization or family dynamics. Those are all great and important subjects. But because of my political and moral preoccupations, I think my subconscious needed me to write a social novel, needed me to write a novel that was a dramatization of things that I've written about elsewhere, sort of in a much more finger-wagging way. I wanted to bring myself and a bunch of readers into a drama where they could see everybody can act in the best motives, and these larger corrupt systems are still going to create terrible outcomes. I, after finishing it, I sort of thought, okay, I've done this. I believe in what I've done. I think artists have to have the freedom to morally imagine their way into other kinds of lives. That's really their job. If they want to enlarge the reader's moral imagination, they have to enlarge their own, but they better get it right if they're writing from a position of privilege about characters who are disenfranchised. So I set about, I did a lot of research, but I also set about sending the manuscript out to pretty much everybody who I thought might be able to help me. Certainly Latinx friends, a cultural sensitivity reader, a police officer who was an officer during the time in question, my friend Paul Salopek, who is a brilliant reporter, grew up in Mexico and was a brilliant reporter on the border and knew a lot about immigration and had written about that extensively. My wife certainly, and lots of women who I thought would be able to offer some perspective on how the female characters are portrayed, just as many beta readers as I could. And ultimately, the reader gets to decide whether, whether it feels like a fair and accurate portrayal. The only thing that I can say is that my effort is to understand all the characters and to be merciful towards them, not absolve them, but to understand what their motives are. And that to me counts pretty much as most important. Especially if you're going to write outside of your experience, you better not be flattening anybody out into a caricature.
Did anything surprise you as you were listening to Lorena's voice as you were writing her through the book?
Well, one thing that surprised me is that she kept putting herself into dangerous situations. And I am maybe as a writer, I can have a little more courage, but I'm generally a pretty frightened person, anxious person. And I was sort of astonished, maybe that was part of the pleasure of spending time with her, that she just wouldn't give up. She was absolutely dogged, and she kept making decisions that, you're saying as a reader, don't do that, don't do that. And also sort of maybe more quietly, oh, good, she's going to do that. Oh, good, she's going to do that. Because it's just such a pleasure to encounter somebody like that who is going to have to do extraordinary things in order to even have a chance of transcending the story that she's born into. So her courageousness surprised and delighted me continually.
Another element in your sort of teaching style has been your portraying sex and sexuality in a direct and engaged manner. You teach writers not to avoid sexual interactions between characters. And it made me curious about your nickname for your protagonist, Lo. It harkened to Lolita, the classic book that is sort of the most classic white male gaze and sexualized girl in literature.
Yes.
In your book, I'm going to try to stay vague for spoiler reasons, but you shift into sexuality from the vantage point of a girl in early adolescence, and sort of flipping the Lolita script.
Yep.
Can you speak to your challenge in trying to bring emotional truth to that sort of aspect of her life?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a very vulnerable, risky proposition. But it's also, I think, quite foolish to imagine that children and especially adolescents don't have a sexual life. They do. They also have very little power and very little understanding of what they're up to. That doesn't mean they don't have bodies and urges. And for me, like the nickname Lo is given to her by Rosemary Stallworth. It's a bit of a wink to the reader, but it's also, hey, that is what's happening to her. There's a certain kind of possession that is taken of her by each of the Stallworth parents for different reasons. It's inherently exploitative. And the central work for me was not to deny that she would have this insane crush, and that it would be partly from the regard that Marcus Stallworth gives her, the respect, the understanding, the connection that they have, having really led lives that are more similar than other characters in the book, because Marcus has had a very hard shake in things, as we've come to find out, but that there is as well an undeniable, though ambiguous, charge between them that, again, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it's not what their relationship is built on. I think their relationship is built on a sense of being sort of akin in some way, having the scientific mind and this desire to sort of get away from the fraudulence of this sort of suburban world. But there is, in addition to that, as part of the engine of their interaction, certainly from Lorena's point of view, she is really, in a way that she cannot control, excited by and turned on by this guy. And I think it's foolish for us to imagine that that is not how adolescents operate. They get intense crushes all the time, and sometimes they act on them in small and large ways, and regardless of whether they act on them in the real world, they're powerful within their inner life. And that's, I think, what I was trying to get at, is that part of what is exciting for Lorena walking into the Stallworth house is the sense of ease and assurance, of money, of a larger life, of ambition, of being visible. And in addition to all that, a male figure who sees her, respects her, and gives her just enough, a certain kind of attention to really trigger her sense of sort of erotic excitement in ways that, you know, are disturbing but also real. I really hate when we pretend that we don't have these powerful libidinal urges. That's why I talk about writing sex, because people have sex and it's important to them. And even if they're just having fantasy or, you know, solo sex, those are still sexual experiences. It's not the only show, but it's part of what makes us who we are. We all have an erotic and sexual life, and so your character should too.
There's a phrase I've read in essays that you've written that I really like, that about the subject. You say, writing sex scenes is building psychologically and emotionally reliable on-ramps to moments that really matter.
I mean, I think that's true of any kind of scene, but certainly when the only reason to have a scene with sex in it in a book is because you're stripping the characters naked emotionally and psychologically. We are all, when it comes time to be in a sexual situation, sort of hopeful and ecstatic and anxious, you know, and hyped up. It matters to us a lot. We're paying careful attention. Somebody could get hurt. Somebody could get great pleasure, which is also frightening to us. There's a lot at stake. And what I believe generally, whether it's a scene that is sexual or a scene that involves conflict or a scene that involves a sort of sudden revelation, a physical risk or a moral or psychic risk, is that our job is to build, as writers, is to build that ramp that feels reliable to these particular moments where a lot is at stake, and then to slow down as the action's unfolding so that we can move inside the character's experiences.
So more personally, it seems like the voice in this novel shifts away from what people sort of know as the Steve Almond voicey, humorous, sarcastic voice that we all love in stories and other books. Does it reflect for you a shift in where you might be standing and looking at your life in the world?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was thinking about this because a lot of this novel, I think, arises from the coincidence of having gone to El Paso, Texas, right after I graduated college. And when you're in El Paso, suddenly the story of immigration and the border, which is, you know, demagogued in a very ridiculous invading army, all this nonsense. When you're there, you really realize, oh, it's just like having a very, 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 very poor country up against a very rich country. It's just natural that people are going to want, who are ambitious and who want to lead a larger life and give opportunity to their kids, they're naturally going to want to come to the United States. When I was 21, 22, 23, 24 in El Paso, I saw that, I absorbed it. I could see the day maids coming across the Rio Grande from a little balcony. If I got up early enough, I could see all of the pathos of their, you know, carrying their work clothes on their head in a plastic sack and scampering up the other side of the Rio Grande and having to, you know, change their clothes at dawn and hope they weren't going to get chased down by an INS van and so forth. I could see it, but it doesn't mean I was ready to write about it or that I really understood it. It was just me witnessing something, and it kind of stayed unresolved. I was aware of it, but I wasn't engaged with it. In fact, it took me like 20, 25 years for me to write the story, My Life in Heavy Metal, maybe 20 years after I was in El Paso, or maybe 15. I wrote a story that focused on my experience in El Paso, but it was like my job as a newspaper pop critic and covering these heavy metal concerts and sort of the sexual idiocy of my insecurity causing me to behave badly in relationships. And that was really what I was ready to write about at that time. I was ready to take on that part of the El Paso experience. Well, that's me, you know, at 35 saying, okay, I can start to get a little bit of purchase on the kind of idiot that I was. Another 15 years and whatever America has gone through, this kind of moral regression that we're suffering through, I think I'm thinking about, and I have three kids of my own, I'm thinking about things a little bit more deeply. And now when El Paso returns to me, it really is the issue of what I was witnessing and what it is, what immigration really means and what it means to be an undocumented person, what it means to suffer the possibility of deportation at a moment's notice versus the insane sort of accident of being born American, the flukiness of it, and the sense in which we somehow view that as like an achievement or a birthright. It's just dumb luck. And when you live on the border, you realize that very powerfully because there's a line. And at night, when you look out, the lights in El Paso are all bright and the lights in Juarez were sort of speckled blue. Even at night, you could tell where that line was. And it was an arbitrary line. It was a man-made line. Scorpions didn't know about that line, right? The natural world said, what are you talking about? This is just a, you know, ridiculous arbitrary thing that's been created by human beings. So I think for me, like trying to take that on took a lot longer for me to say, well, maybe there was something more serious. And honestly, the early novels that I wrote were full of me being glib and clever and trying to sort of entertain the reader because I think I didn't really have a story to tell. The muse hadn't walked me into or walked somebody like Lorena into my imagination. And so I tried to sort of get by on shtick. And that doesn't go, you know, you can get away with that for a few paragraphs or a few pages, but you can't for a whole book because the reader wants story. They want to care about somebody and they want that somebody put into danger and they want to know whether that somebody's going to survive it.
So I'm thinking about other titles you're mentioning, like Candy Freak and Against Football. You were confronting your own obsessions in those moments, yep. Right, with watching sports. And is there a confrontation with self that played out as you were creating this novel, sort of as a...
Yeah, I mean, I think...
called it being born on third base.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I was trying to do is stop writing about me and my life, even though obviously I think we're always writing autobiographically. It was a greater act of imagination for me to say, all right, who is Guerrero, the police officer who's a central character? Who is Lorena? Who is Tony, her older brother? Who is Graciela, her mom? Who are these people? Who are the stalwarts? Because I'm not actually similar to anybody in the book, maybe come closest in being sort of a jerk soccer player like Glenn Stallworth, the older brother of Jenny. But there really isn't anybody who maps out to my own particular experience. My job was to sort of figure out who all the characters were and what it was that they were, the secrets that they were keeping. The other thing that made the book easier to write was that everybody in this house of freaks that Lorena walks into is bearing a secret or two. And some of them are secrets that they're keeping from the world, and the most interesting and dangerous ones are the secrets that they're keeping from themselves. I think that was something I learned from working on Dear Sugars, was that really the most dangerous secrets are the ones that we just can't even admit to ourselves. We're unaware of them. We're keeping them a secret from themselves. You know, things like this relationship is no longer serving me and I have to get out. Like, that's a secret that a lot of people keep from themselves. Or another secret is that, you know, we'll tell ourselves the story that really what needs to happen is for our partner or for our child to behave differently and they need to change how they're doing business, when the truth is actually we're the ones who need to change. I've run into that one a lot.
Did writing the book change you in ways that you didn't expect?
I think it allowed me to take myself a little bit more seriously. Not, I guess what I mean is that at the same time I was just chasing Lorena, I think I was realizing, oh, this is what it feels like when a big story is working. And you don't have to just keep trying to charm the reader and desperately flogging the language. Your job is to just be curious and humble and patient and let the characters and their experience be the center of it. And in a way, one thing I realized is that the kind of preachy narrator that is, I think, predominates in some of my nonfiction, where in Bad Stories or Against Football, there's a part of me that's sort of saying, ah, look at this terrible, corrupt, you know, situation. That in a novel, your job is, it belongs, the story belongs to the characters and their experiences in a moment-to-moment way, not to the noble views of the author. Those were sort of broadcast in early drafts of the novel in the voice of this narrator who would kind of hover above and sort of observe things and tell the reader, here's the lesson. And it was awful. And I got rid of almost all of it because I realized that that was me playing God again and condescending to the characters and to the reader, frankly. Readers get it. You read the book. I don't need to explain. I can talk a little bit about, well, here's what I was interested in, you know, ex post facto, but the reader gets it. And I think a lot of what I was able to do is realize, oh yeah, the reader gets the experience of being in the story. The reader doesn't need a commentator. They don't need help understanding what it all means. Just stay with the characters, stay with them in their moments of danger.
That's so interesting, because part of what you're saying does sound like, this might be a little cheesy, but it's like you sniffed out anything that might be construed as sort of explaining or teaching, because, you know, and that is such a up and back way to view who you're engaging with as the reader.
I mean, interestingly, you know me as a teacher, and a lot of people know me. That's good. That's a great. It's important to be able to explain things. But the thing about being a teacher is that you're hung up on mastery. You know, I know my rap. I know what I want to say. It's easy for me to diagnose, you know, what's going on with a piece of writing or to explain it. That's not a position of humility. That's a position of kind of moral surety, you know, like, oh, I know exactly what the problem is. It's much more interesting to ultimately to get rid of that, all of that, the didactic part of myself. And I could feel myself in the narrator cleaving to that, just making sure that the student got the lesson. But this isn't a lesson. It's a story. And in a story, what you get to do is allow the reader or compel the reader into the experience of the characters. And then you have to trust that the reader is not your student. The reader is another human being who's hearing your story. And they're not looking for a lesson. They're looking for an experience. They're looking for an emotional event. And it took me a while. That was later drafts where gradually, I promise you, I got rid of almost every single moment where that narrator is butting in and saying, you see the evil, you see the corruption. It's like, dude, just shut up. Save it for a nonfiction book. Or maybe even just get rid of it all together.
I mean, I would argue, having read the book, it makes the kind of lurching consequences of sort of the machines, the deadly machines of the powers that be, more devastating to be in a closer up to it without any abstraction, without any commentary. Right. I think that's part of what made this book so beautifully painful. It was so painful.
Yeah. It's tough, and people will tell me that, and you know, there's part of me that almost, like you were saying, this isn't the funny, you know, Steve Allman, whatever. You know, I have a sort of reputation for using the comic impulse as a way of kind of softening, and though there are, I think, moments of a little bit of levity in this book, it's quite serious, and it's quite grave and sad. I almost want to like apologize to people and say, like, this is it's kind of upsetting what happens, but also the world's upsetting. And I see no reason to, like, I'm not a big fan of kind of worrying about the reader being okay. It's more that I don't want people to feel who have a certain idea of the kind of experience they're gonna have to be like, geez, that was dark. And it is dark, but look around. It's a dark season that we're in. And you know, the novelist, the writer is absorbing what's happening in the zeitgeist around them. And if they want to accurately reflect what's really going on, they have to be able to say, the characters are not all going to be all right. That's not really, that's a fairy tale. That's not reality. For me, part of the problem with the Reagan Revolution, which is, you know, what I'm sort of morally interrogating here, is that it was predicated on a myth, on a fairy tale, that the United States and America is this great mansion on the hill. And, you know, you do not get to ask the relevant questions. Who's living in the mansion? Who's cleaning the mansion, right? You know, who's scrubbing the floors, and who's going to get arrested if they trespass on the mansion? Those are the questions that we should have been asking, not because Reagan was necessarily in bad faith. I think he believed it, but he was a salesman. He was a marketer. And we are swimming in marketing. That is, in not just corporate marketing. Now we're all marketing ourselves on Facebook and the other social media apps and art. And, yeah, right. Our job is to try to undo all that and say, actually, this is the way the world really works. It can be upsetting, but unless we face it, like Baldwin says, you cannot hope to solve problems that you refuse to confront.
Mm. There's something beautiful about the way it makes it, you as the writer, more vulnerable, actually, to bring forward, this is my emotional metabolism of what we're living in, without, you know, things we love about your writing. But to sort, it does make you seem to sort of take a coat off and yourself even more forward.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good way of putting it. It's like, you know, it's not that I've been horsing around or that I haven't been sort of grappling with what's happening in our country, but I don't think I was doing that. I think I was doing that sort of with my superego. And this one, I really wanted to put all of myself into it and enter into the experience of the characters. And that's why when I later in the book, I found myself sinking into these characters and saying, what is lodged in their history that is going to determine how they behave and whether they're okay in the end? And they're not all going to be okay. And it's because they've suffered certain things. And unless I can go back and suffer with them, the reader won't fully understand it. And I think that is, you know, that's what I've been up to in some ways in short stories and some of my nonfiction, but not in as sustained a way. That's the way I would say it, not in that sustained way.
And just what you're saying makes me feel like that kind of mechanism of the more that deeply you embedded yourself in the subconscious motivations, or, you know, the deeper emotional life of them, the more you're able to be invisible as the narrator, the more you're able to sort of get to be more invisible as you're more present. I guess I just love that juxtaposition that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the goal, is for me to kind of disappear into the characters. And I think that was the pleasure of it, because in a way I was tired of myself. And I think, I'm not saying that like negatively, but I was tired of writing in the mode of like, okay, let me look at my life and mine it. What am I, you know, candy, football, rock and roll? And it's like, enough. I want to have my own moral imagination enlarged. I want to enter into these characters and these places. And it was really for me during the pandemic, which is when the second half of the book was written, it was a respite. You know, go away to we'd go get these little cheap Airbnbs. My wife and I, she's a writer too. We'd take every other month, we'd go off for, you know, 6 or 7 days. And for me to get out of the pressure cooker of what was happening and be able to enter this world was, I think both artistic progress, but also a great pleasure in a way. It brought me into an imagined world in a much more sustained way than I'd been able to do before. And, you know, so that's why I'm very happy that the book got finished. I don't really, I mean, I'm delighted that it's in the world, but for me, the achievement was even in occupying that imagined space.
And being able to sustain yourself in that space through to you and your characters arriving at the the ending together, it sounds really satisfying.
Especially, well, the ending was tough because I worked on it really hard. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want, you know, I got notes from people that I respect saying, does it have to be so dark? And then the real question for me was like, well, maybe it doesn't, but if there's going to be some hope, it's got to be earned. It's got to be Lorena figuring out with help in the right moments, figuring out a way through, not to like bliss or happiness, but just to a place where her full potential is realized. And that, for me, that was very exciting. You'll also probably notice that there are a lot of teachers in this book, and that the teachers play an important role. So that was important for me too.
So I found parallels between the novel and God Bless America. I was thinking about the two in comparison with each other, because they both get at the fate of America and the thorniness coming back to the American dream, which are painfully laid out in the novel, like the versions of the American dream played out. Where do you see the American dream today, given, especially today, with attacks on women's freedom and in this moment?
The pendulum swings, you know, and two things can happen at the same time that are moving in opposite directions, you know. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you can have an increasing sense of enlightenment, really, when it comes to, I don't know, stuff like how gender is defined and how people's sexuality is defined. You can have an increasing sense of tolerance, you know, for instance, for gay people, you know, the LGBTQ, there's much greater awareness.